tachyometer that gives feedback to that servo mechanism. If dirt and temperature and vibration and whatever creates a failure, open circuit or whatever, of that potentiometer indicating the position of the butterfly. It can, again, for a bunch of reasons, failure of the motor, failure of the potentiometer, can go to wide open and be stuck. And we who work in electronics, or military electronics, know that the lowest reliability component in the world is a potentiometer. Every potentiometer you put into a piece of military electronics, you have to go to Congress, to, so to speak, to justify it's got to be there. They would rather have you adjust the values of fixed resistors that you put in or whatever, laser trimming, anything else but a potentiometer. So that's another failure mechanism. Again, the only real defense, as I see it, is smart brakes, which either commands idle of the engine. If that doesn't work, it kills the ignition. Smart brakes, there's got to be multiple steps to it, where it eventually kills the ignition to kill the engine when you put on the brakes. And again, Bill is scaring me, where he tells me you've got this complicated shift lever mechanism where they make sure that you can't hit it by mistake with your elbow. That tells me it's more difficult to find neutral. And that's what happened to that poor highway patrolman in California who died with his family. He couldn't find neutral on the vehicle because it was a complicated shift mechanism on a vehicle he wasn't familiar with. I forget who gets the next one to make comments. This is still a serious problem, and it's life-threatening. And we mobile operators want our mobile not to kill us. Therefore, this is important. I don't know of a more important subject right now. Again, I'm angry that the media, the newspaper, and the news reports, in general, are not giving the public enough information of what they need to know to survive. Just telling us how bad it is only half the story, the lower half. Anybody have any further comments? KQLIW.
I got the perfect solution. Yay! Thank you, Dick. Thank you, everybody. I am a rich guy. Ha ha! The perfect solution is an ejectable cabin. How about that, Dick? RIW and 20, leave it to Trump.
Give that man a cigar.
Yeah.
A chicken ring is what a pilot would call it. The ejection module. However, to have an ejection module, Alex, you've got to strap yourself in a seat in a very complicated manner. What a pilot does is he's got all kinds of training. He's got this parachute and all these very fancy pyrotechnics below him. His legs are captured. His arms are captured. His torso is captured. His head is captured. He's wearing a helmet. The pyrotechnics is strong enough to blast his chair right through that canopy, blast him 1,000 feet in the air and open the parachute. And it has to be, the pilot ejection has to be in the right sequence. If there is a passenger alongside of the pilot when that ejection seat is initiated, the rockets on the bottom of that chair will probably kill the person alongside of him. As you can see, it's an extremely expensive technique. In the case of a $400 million airplane and a very expensive pilot, you're willing to do that, to put this into average, inexpensive passenger vehicles. And what happens if you're in a tunnel when that ejection seat goes off? I know of a pilot who decided, because his wife gave him a real tough time, he wanted to commit suicide. He climbed into the cockpit of a fighter aircraft that was inside of a hangar. He blasted himself up against the ceiling because he wanted to die. My goodness, was he successful. Over to you, Alex. N2NNU, K2LIW.
KC2QIQ with one more comment.
Let's see. Well, seemingly Dick took it seriously. Well, here, Dick, this is why I spoke about a cabin and not an individual seat. The whole cabin should be blasted off together with the idiots inside. QIQ, go ahead.
You've got it, Quinn. Wait for the beep.
Just one more thing in defense of the spring. You know, spring returns on carburetors and fuel injection have been around a real long time and got a tremendous record for safety as far as that's concerned. Not too many people have really had these kinds of accidents with the return spring. And the interesting thing about return springs are most cars made from like the late happens is they put one spring inside the other, so that maybe you don't have the full return potential of that spring, but you always have at least the second one on the inside. So it's basically one spring around the outside spring, and it was put there basically for that reason. But I mean, there's always some possible way that it can fail, but I think just in terms of safety, and if you look at the throttle cable itself, if it opens, then basically your throttle just goes to zero, which is a safe condition. Wide open throttle is a real nasty one, and I think that if you just were to analyze the number of components and the number of failures that you could have, I think that they might want to remove them from cars for a while until they really analyze all the failure mechanisms that they have. And said, at this point in time, I think I'm not very comfortable with the idea of having some kind of a remotely controlled throttle at this point. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Wesley recognized. Yeah, but there's more going on than just adjusting the throttle, though, Glenn. You described a backup mechanism that's being used with two springs, one inside the other, and have it help you if one spring fails and the throttle becomes very soft and the person ignores it, and eventually the second spring fails. I guess a not-so-kind person will say, well, he's ignored a serious situation. He shouldn't have, and he deserves to get into trouble. I don't agree with that one. But anyhow, you'll never pass the emission control requirements and the mileage requirements with just a mechanically operated throttle. The modern-day vehicle with that fly-by-wire throttle commands a computer. The computer selects a butterfly position. It selects timing. It selects mixture. It selects EGR setting. It sets a whole bunch of things to control the emissions, control the mileage, to control the efficiency, to control the power, the timing, and so on. So it's not mechanics anymore. There's too many things going on at once. They think it's got to be a computer. And unfortunately, I found a couple of articles today describing how the gum that you can get into a carburetor can mechanically jam the butterfly, even though, and that can override the servo motor that's trying to move that butterfly that's in the carburetor. So there's mechanical failures that can occur if the carburetor's not kept clean enough. And there are certain kinds of conditions where road dirt or whatever can aggravate that condition. So smart brakes, a trained operator who knows how to get the car into neutral, regardless of what speed he's at, who knows how to kill the engine by holding down the starter button for 3 seconds. We have to educate the consumer. That's number one. Number two, we got to add these other backup systems like smart brakes. And we've got to tell these people to blame a person because he is ignorant, because he doesn't know. That's crazy. That's blaming the victim. We have to inform the potential victim. 4 million vehicles are going to be recalled. That's a lot of potential victims. If 0.1% of those people run into this problem, that's 4,000 potential fatalities. You got to do something. I don't know of a higher priority than Al-Qaeda in this case. Was that Wesley or Alex? You know who you are, though, who wanted to make a further comment. Go right ahead. K2RIW.
Yeah, K-E-Y would like to say something.
K2QIQ with a comment.
Both of you guys are on the list.
I just had in the 90s, in the Duke from 67. The problem was not with the spring. The problem was with the old carpet. And that might happen. But what I was to say is, on it, pedal and cushion. At least there was something about it. Now, the pedal mostly was the car's operation doctor. Now, you said if enough light and or size depends which bird was looking for. But it depends on the transistor. The phototransistor, dead light. Four legs, five legs are. And then I think that's six legs. So, if you put from the side, not the side of from the pedal, but from the other side into the screen, you enable the device. Now, another thing is cruise control. The cruise control is able to disable, there is another thing. And that is the computer. Now, instead of the switches, if there is one single thing that controls all of these three factors, then we have actually the solution for it. Now, this could be by anybody who knows something about the automotive, or one who is the component for the car that could put in one microcontroller that is considered on top of it. Am I wrong? Yes, please.
I like that one, Wesley. Now I'm going to give it a name. I'm going to call it the kill switch, or the panic button. It's going to be a red button on the instrument panel, very similar to the great big button you got for the emergency flashing light. With that panic button, you press it. It opens up those three switches you just described. We need a panic switch. I was working in a very dangerous room which has a whole lot of high power transmitters, which is simulating all of the high power transmitters on the B-1 bomber. On the wall of that room was a great big red button. We called it the panic switch. When something went wrong in that room, with lots and lots of kilowatts of RF energy running around, if something went wrong, and one day it did, we ran over and hit that button right away, and it killed everything. You need a kill switch that kills all the power generating circuits. That's the next step. You're on to something good there. Okay, we're going to go to Mel and Glenn in that order. Mel, K2KEY. How are the smart guys at Brooklyn solve this problem, Mel? K2LIW.
What?
Okay, this is K2KEY. First of all, as far as the old carburetor system, I got a 69 AA Super Sport, and I have worked on that carburetor many a time, and I've had the linkage disconnected. That engine will not go with this spring action that is part of that carburetor and the vacuum line on there that's always trying to pull the butterfly to close. You've got to override that by actually pulling it. So yes, they do have that double spring. They've had that double spring like 57 Chevy, my 60 Chevy has that double spring operation. But like I say, I'll take the linkages off with the springs and all, and you see that carburetor not accelerate. They had a straightforward system. Some of the things that they had years ago were not so stupid. You know, you never heard of those things because we've gone too much as Mercedes-Benz. My brother has a Mercedes. A lot of problems he's had with Mercedes. Made it very hush-hush. You never hear about some of those problems. All electrical and electronic problems, they've overdone it. And his is being a convertible. He had amazing trouble because one time the top was down and it started to rain. Water got into that console, that center console where all the controls are, opening instances, doing all kinds of things, and boy, he was in trouble. Something they never considered, that he's going to have a convertible with the top down and it's going to start to rain. What do? You're riding along. You got to pull over to put the top up. Well, that's modern thinking. You know, we're getting maybe too carried away with so much electronics in the car. Number two, I'd like to answer one or two questions, Dick. Otherwise, I don't know what to say to these people anymore. If we're not going to continue the emails, I'll just shut it down, Dick. Over.
You're right. Although we are on a life-threatening subject that's kind of important, but I'm going to go a couple more minutes. Even with the mechanical linkage, with all of its safety that it usually has, and yeah, I completely forgot about the Mercedes problem. Mercedes, BMW, Audi, Toyota, we now are realizing they've all had, to some degree, this problem at some time, the runaway vehicle problem, because of electronic errors from a zillion different possible sources. But even the simple mechanical linkage, a few people have died on that one, Mel, with a perfectly operated spring, with a perfectly clean carburetor that doesn't jam, but a failure of an engine mount. When the engine mount fails in a particular way, the engine tilts over to one side when you command power. That pulls on the linkage. That gives a phony command to the carburetor, go to full blast. As the carburetor goes to full blast, the tilt of the engine on the failure of the motor mount goes further. And you've got, again, a runaway engine at maximum power, maximum torque. So, again, even the mechanical linkage, although it's darn rare, there are people who have gotten in trouble on that one. You've got to educate the user. He's got to know what to do if it occurs. He's got to think about it. Because in the panic of the situation, the chances of doing the right thing, if you don't think about it ahead of time, if you haven't been informed, the chances of doing the right thing are not so good. Glenn's the last person we're going to go to on this one, then we're going to go to some of our letters. QCQ. You got it, Glenn. You know who you are. K2RIW.
KC12DY.
Very good, Dick. As a matter of fact, I think we covered this one well enough, and I want to yield my time back to Mel and get right into the mail deck. KC2QIQ.
Rich, make it brief. LTY, go ahead and give us a couple of words. How are the guys in your town solve this one?
How did you know a broken engine mount in a racing car will lead to the death of the driver? It's very dangerous. Any mechanical failure can lead to the death of a driver.
And that's the word for Mineola. And he knows, he's been there. He's been a race car driver for many years. And he's seen people get in trouble with a runaway engine. You've got to have an educated driver who knows when the engine runs away, he's got to reach for neutral and or kill switch on the engine. Other than that, you're probably not going to make it. Mel, K2KEY, what's the crisis in the mailbag? What's the biggest problem these guys would like solutions? And once again, we didn't promise mail. You know that, you guys. We're going to do our best, but it's not our promise. Our promise is live arguments on the air among guys who are trying to find the right solution to a very nasty problem. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Hey, this is K2KEY. Well, as far as the engine mount breaking and all that stuff, the engine is very unusual because what they did with the engine mount back in my 69 Chevy, they have an extra piece that sits on. I could call the cup, I think. I don't remember what they called it, but it was like a double clamp that sits over it that's there only if the rubber piece was the brake loop. And the engine was able then to pull itself up. In other words, this is like a double protection for that, so that it's just there for that one particular problem if the engine mount was to actually come, unglued from its from the plate that tiles on it. It's more than that because they also the newer engine mounts I have in there, they have the rivet through them and also. It's a little different design and everything like that. I've never had any problems like that, and I've done 527,000 miles on that car. It's traveled. One of the questions here from this young person here, I told him, I'm trying to see if I can get him some answers, is on an antenna. It's on a compact beam that he inherited. He'd like to get on 20 meters, and let me describe the beam to you. Let it drop, unless you want to make a comment first, stick over.
Go right ahead. Way to drop.
900 horsepower. It doesn't matter what kind of motor you have.
That was putting out, of all things they were doing, putting out rigs and things of that sort. I know they had tuners and everything. But they did put out a compact beam. It was called a beam that your neighbors will love because it looks like maybe I can oversize television antenna, and it had a director and a driven element, just the two elements, no reflector driven element, a director and a driven element. That's it. It was the director was about, it was pretty, for 20 meters, it was pretty small, it was under 15 feet, the element, and it had a boom about 7 feet, if I remember correctly. I'm going to describe the antenna. And it had traps. It had a trap on each element. On each element, we trapped. what else? Let me see this drive. What else should I describe on it? Let me see. I'm trying to fix the antenna. Like I say, you could turn it with a regular TV rotor and all, and was great with a little 20-meter beam, and was very popular, sold very cheap. This young guy, he got one from somebody, had it in his garage. One of the traps is missing. They didn't call it a trap, they called it a high Q coils at the time, of course. Is missing. He'd like to know how he could go ahead and duplicate it, because he's still got the other ones on there. How can he determine what's in there? How can he measure it? Or how can he determine how he could make one, Dick, over?
The first thing you do is you tell him he came to the right place. That's a damn good question. Let me tell you how a compact beam works. First of all, a Yagi antenna by Mr. Yagi and Uda. 1928 is when they published. Beautiful. One of the best chunks of electronics ever designed, devised by mankind, by my standards. It's got the elegance of simplicity. There's very little there, and boy, it does magic. As far as the amount of gain and directivity you get out of very little material. That's the good news. Also, good common sense would lead you to believe that if you're only going to build a two-element Yagi, good common sense would tell you you're going to build a driven element and a reflector. Everybody believes that. You can picture in your mind what the reflector does. Well, common sense will fail you. If you know how to tune it correctly, and you're only going to use one parasitic element, you get more bang for the money out of a director than you do for a reflector, when you're only putting one of them there. So driven element and director gives you more performance than than just a reflector and driven element. Second of all, the way the Yagi works, let me drop, is you've got a dipole-like device that you and I call the driven element. Its whole purpose in life is to hit resonance at your center frequency. Resonance is defined as that bulb of electrons going down that piece of driven element as you drive it with that transmission line. You got a cloud of electrons that go down the end of the element. They hit the end. It's an open circuit. Only a little bit of it gets radiated. That's the bad news about antennas. And a lot of that cloud comes back, and you want the cloud to come back exactly a half wave delayed in time. So electronically, the driven element must be a half wavelength long. Period. Now, if it was a full-size element on 20 meters, half wavelength is 10 meters, it's going to be close to 30 feet long. You can take that dipole driven element, force it into resonance at a hell of a lot less than 30 feet long by using loading coils near the base, by using top hat capacitors near the top, by zigzagging it, meandering it. There's a zillion ways that you can make a resonator in approximately the shape of a dipole and physically tip to tip a hell of a lot shorter. And if you use low loss materials, you'll get 98% efficiency, even though you've done all of those nasty things to that driven element. As long as it hits resonance, as long as it is made out of low-loss materials, you'll get full performance out of a shrunken-down driven element. The director, you can do the same thing. The director is a resonator at a particular position in space. As long as you fall, as long as you can make that director be a little bit shorter electronically than the driven element by the right amount and hit the right resonant frequency and physically it's located in the right position in space out in front of the driven element, you'll get full performance out of it. 98% of all the guys on 20 meters, you tell them, I'm going to build a compact beam, and they'll say, because it's so small, it's going to have very little capture area, you're going to have very decreased performance. Good sounding common sense. Dead wrong. If you're smart enough to use the right materials, as far as the length of the elements is concerned, you can squeeze it down a whole lot and still get 98% of the performance of a full-size beam. The one dimension you can't shrink down is the length of the boom, the spacing between the elements. You shrink that spacing, you're going to start losing performance no matter what the hell you do. So, now once you know what it's doing and how it's doing it, I'm going to teach you how to make that missing component. Let me drop. The good news is he has one good operating trap, which really is a loading coil. Some of the length of that driven element is wrapped up into that coil. That's what all it is, the loading coil. You're electronically creating more length when you don't want to use physical length, and you've wrapped some of it into a coil. The one coil he's got probably can be disconnected. In other words, it's got telescoping tubing going into it and coming out of it, and he can disconnect those pieces of tubing. Primarily, it is an inductor. It is an inductor that has a very specific amount of inductance at, say, 14.1 megacycles, his favorite operating frequency. The coil that he's going to fabricate, the missing one, all he's got to do is make a coil with a mounting mechanism that will accept the input and output pieces of tubing and be mechanically strong enough. A proper plastic rod or fiberglass rod will do that. Then he's going to wrap a coil onto that rod, and he's got to give it the exact same amount of inductance at 14.1 megacycles as the one that he's got. He's going to take the one that he's got. He's going to fabricate some kind of a large physical dimension capacitor. He can do it by taking a chunk of sheet metal from the left side, a chunk of sheet metal from the right side, connecting it to where the tubing of the driven element would connect, bring the sheets of metal close together with overlap right over the top of the coil, and adjust that spacing until the coil hits resonance at 14.1 megacycles. He's going to resonate that coil on the good one. He's going to find out how many picofarads of capacitance is required to do it. I showed that the pieces of sheet metal or great big wide pieces of conductor are just going to bring you up to the point where you put probably a variable capacitor, maybe a fixed capacitor with a variable across it. You're going to find the amount of capacitance that resonates the good inductor at 14.1 megs. Once you've got that capacitor in your hand, you're then going to remount it on the new one that you're fabricating. You're going to wrap a coil that has approximately the same diameter, approximately the same turns, but even if you can't see inside, it doesn't matter. You're going to make a coil on the new one that you're fabricating, and you're going to adjust the diameter, the length, the number of turns, the spacing of the coils. You're going to do whatever you do so that the new one, again, hits the exact same resonance at 14.1 megacycles with that exact capacitor. You have now electronically duplicated the exact same, you have emulated the exact same coil of the good one. You've now made the new one act identical to the good one. Put that antenna all back together, and it will fly. That's a strongly felt opinion. There's a couple of details in there, but at least you see the direction toward the solution. If you can't find the solution, if the manufacturer doesn't exist, he won't sell you another one, and you want to fabricate it, that's what you and I would do, Mel. K2KEY, wait for the beep, K2LIW.
It says K2KEY. Well, I told him if it worst came to worst, if he wants to take it, he'd take the other one, as I could say, two on each element. So the one that's missing, if he wants to send me the other one, I would measure the inductance and give him, you know, a sketch of the physical size of what he has to wind, basically. However, he does say that friends of his have handheld antenna analyzers, such as the MFJ, puts out. Do you think he could find any information with a handheld antenna analyzer? Over.
I'm going to add something to what you just said, Mel. You're on the right track, but I think your method you just described did not go far enough. To measure the inductance of the coil that he's got only gets you halfway home. It's not that he wants the new coil to have the same inductance. It's got to have the same inductance at 14.1 megacycles. When you're building these great big distributed coils for high power transmitter work on the driven element of an antenna, it's got a lot of distributed mechanical characteristics to it. You could measure the inductance at 1 megacycle, and you could measure the inductance at 14.1 megacycles, and you will get two different numbers. be careful. Because of the way that is distributed, the way it's part of that mechanical assembly of that driven element, it must present the exact same inductance, but that inductance must be measured exactly at the operating frequency per se, 14.1 megacycles, if that's your favorite frequency. It's got to be that inductance at that frequency. That's the reason why I said you find what capacitor makes that coil all by itself on the good one, resonate at 14.1 on your grid dip meter. I forgot to say it's grid dip meter or some equivalent. There's ways you can hook up a network analyzer to do the same thing as a grid dip meter, but you're going to confirm the resonance at 14.1, sweeping with your transmitter into the right kind of a network, a bridge network. Feeding that coil will allow you to do it, but you've got to force it to display resonance at 14.1 with your variable capacitor across it. Then you go back to your brand new coil that you're fabricating with that exact same capacitor, force the brand new coil to hit the exact same resonance at 14.1 megacycles. Now you've done a perfect Chinese copy, if you know what I mean. You measure it at any other frequency, I think there's a 50-50 chance it won't behave the way you want it to, Mel. There's a little more going on here than first meets the eye, because it's a great big mechanical induced inductor that's distributed in space. It is frequency sensitive. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Well, of course, that frequency. In fact, I told him you can find the frequency in which the minimum SWR is on the driven element if that's complete, or use the handheld antenna analyzer and find the point where that element was set for. I believe it was set for, according to the article I remember on the original antenna, that it was set for 14.2 at that time. 14.2 was where those antennas were supposedly made and optimized for. They gave you what they did. They actually gave you two settings for that antenna. They gave you, if you're going to be a CW operator, just how to set the length of the tip. You pull the tip out for a different setting for CW, and another one for the phone portion, which is 14.2. That was the adjustment. So I know for a fact that I say that what's there now, that it was set for the phone portion at 14.2. And he confirmed that by just putting a handheld antenna analyzer on and saw that the driven element does, actually show minimum SWR at 14.2. So that's what it's set for. So at that frequency of 14.2, I figured if your base should be inducted and then, mechanically duplicated, it should be put them in fine working position, Dick, over.
Quick. I heard the question. We'll get to you in a second. Mel, but you put the cart before the horse. If the whole antenna is complete, in good working order, he's got a transmission line going to it, now his handheld antenna analyzer will give him beautiful results. And if he had a duplicate of the whole antenna, a good one, and he measures on his antenna analyzer, and then he takes his with the missing component, fabricates the missing component, and keeps fiddling until he got the same reading, that's an approach. Well, there's two things wrong. He doesn't have a whole second good antenna. He can't make that measurement. Number two, he doesn't have a complete driven element. So he can't connect his antenna analyzer and getting a reasonable result on his driven element. A big fraction of that driven element ain't there. That's the missing component. He can't make that measurement. There is one other way he can do it. If the driven element has a center mounting structure that can come apart, so you've got the left-hand side of the driven element with the good coil and the right-hand side of the driven element with the missing coil, he can now contemporarily convert it into a ground plane antenna. He mounts it as a vertical antenna on some kind of radial system that acts like a ground plane. And he makes a measurement on his antenna analyzer of exactly how the good half as a ground plane, vertical ground plane, behaves. Then he unplugs the good one, plugs in the unknown one, and adjusts that coil until he gets the exact same performance. So because his dipole, half of it is gone, he can measure each half independently, make them the same, and then put it together. But right now, with the missing component on that full dipole, I can't see any rational measurement he can make with his antenna analyzer. You see where I'm going with that one now, Mel? K2KEY, K2RIW.
Says K2KEY. No, it's not missing off the driven element. It's missing off the director. The driven element is complete. It works. In other words, it's using it basically as a rotary dipole right now. In fact, that's the way they originally sold it. You could buy this as a, in other words, initially, you could buy this antenna as a rotary dipole for 20 meters. They sold you the driven element. If later on you wanted to make a beam out of it, they would sell you this director with a boom. They converted it into a beam. In fact, I think they even went further one point and they made it into a three element. They supplied a reflector if you wanted to get that. It was another kit that they put a sleeve that they put in the middle that connected the two, added to the boom that you would add another 6 feet or so of boom or whatever, and now you wound up with three elements. I know they sold it several different ways, but his coil is missing off the director. So his driven element is working, so he knows exactly, you know, where that is resonating, his driven element. So I said, if with the handheld, I know the MFJ has that handheld antenna analyzer, and they tell you how to, I believe, measure inductance with it. So I figured maybe the best thing is to take off the one coil off the driven off the director, that's missing, the one on the driven element, one is there, one is missing, the one is there, and work with it with a handheld analyzer with the appropriate capacitor, Dick, over.
Okay, I missed that vital piece of information that the missing coil is on one half of the director, that his driven element is complete. One approach would be to make a leap of faith that if the antenna was designed for 14.2 megacycles, hopefully it has an extremely low standing wave ratio at 14.2, he can mount the antenna far enough above the ground that the ground is not affecting it. He can then build the phony missing director inductor and adjust it until he gets a reasonable standing wave ratio on the driven element with his handheld antenna tuner. That's one approach. But it takes a leap of faith that the original design at the design frequency, when it's all together and working correctly, presents a very good visuar. There's a problem with that one. The antenna might be in good working order, delivering a 1.7 standing wave ratio. And as bad as that sounds, that might be the particular setting at which it gives maximum front-to-back ratio and best gain. In which case, if you tune it for the best visuar and you get a 1.1, but it gives the best performance at 1.7, you'll get in the ballpark, but it's not quite as good as it could be. I'm back to taking apart the coil on the half of the side of the director where the coil is known, finding out what capacitor across it will force it into resonance at 14.2 megacycles. Then with that exact same capacitor placed across the new coil, force it to be at the exact same resonance at 14. Adjust the coil until it's resonating with that capacitor at 14.2 megs. Now those two coils are identical. Your next question is, okay, he doesn't have a grid dip meter. Let me drop. He doesn't have a grid dip meter. How does he use his antenna tuner, which normally doesn't feed a director? And the answer, he can force his antenna tuner to act like a grid dip meter. He can use a reasonable length of coax cable from his handheld antenna tuner. At the end of the coax cable, he makes a coil, a certain number of turns of wire, with a reasonable diameter, where the two ends of the coil connect to the shield and the center conductor of the coax cable. That is like the coil that comes out of the grid dip meter. He holds that parallel to the good coil with the capacitor across it. He puts the antenna tuner in the sweeping mode, and you'll see a great big swish on the screen of some kind as you swish through the resonant frequency of that capacitor and coil combination. So that's a poor man's grid dip meter, a coil of wire on the end of a piece of coax cable on your antenna tuner. As long as it can sweep in frequency, when you hit resonance, you'll see a great big jump on the screen. It'll give you a glitch, an N-shaped curve in one particular frequency. And when you make that 14.2 meg by adjusting the capacitor, just holding that coil parallel, as a poor man's grid dip meter, and he doesn't have a real grid dip meter. Although, you've got a real grid dip meter, you could loan him. So there's a lot of ways you could go. But now he takes the new coil he's fabricating, forces it to act the same way on that grid dip meter. Now he's really fabricated that antenna. That's a strongly felt opinion. K2KEY. And there's probably even better ways. K2RIW. You got to know.
He's got the MFJ antenna analyzer, which has got a meter on it. You know, it will tell you when your antenna is tuned. Are you familiar with the MFJ antenna analyzers, Dick? Over.
I just realized I may have been using the word antenna tuner, and I meant antenna analyzer. Many of these antenna analyzers, I've seen them, but I haven't owned one, and I didn't twiddle with it very long. But many of them will give you a XY display on a liquid crystal display where you can sweep in frequency and display standing wave ratio. Well, I think there's some other modes where you can sweep in frequency and display reflected signal or capacitance or whatever. When you've got a coil of wire on the end of a coax cable going to that antenna analyzer, and as it sweeps in frequency across the resonant frequency of your coil that you're fabricating or the coil that you're measuring, and you're measuring it by having another phony coil of any dimension, doesn't matter, connected to the end of the coax cable, and you're just holding it near, you're making it act like a grid dip meter, I'm reasonably sure that almost every frequency sweeping display type antenna analyzer can be forced to act like a grid dip meter. So if it'll sweep in frequency and display any parameter, you will find the resonant frequency in that manner. And as long as you make the new coil resonate with that fixed capacitor that you found before, and the same way as the good one, and you make the new one act the same, you're home free. K2KEY, K2RIW. Mel first, and then we'll go over to comment. You got it, Mel.
Yeah, Roger. Yeah, well, the MFJ antenna analyzer is got a simple meter on it, and it will show a dip when you are at the resonant frequency. That's basically the way I sort of feel that the best way for him to go with a very simple instrument. It's a very simple instrument to work with, and so he can compare basically what he sees on the, like you say, the existing coil, take it off, and on the existing coil, and then use the physical size of the of that coil, wrap some wire, and like you say, you'll have to trim it. You can go by, in fact, if you know the diameter, once you know the frequency of where that good, the remaining coil is going to resonate. If you look in a book then, in the amateur radio handbook, and you know the diameter, they give you a nice chart, and if you got this physical diameter, the physical length, and it will give you the diameter of the wire necessary to produce a coil at that frequency. I have to look, you know, I haven't looked lately, but I remember in the older manuals, they always had that, those graphs to pick over.
Right after this, I'm going to pick up comments. You're remembering the graphs of inductive reactance and capacitive reactance plotted vertically versus frequency plotted horizontally, and a bunch of slanting 45-degree lines and dotted 45-degree. The reactance chart is what you're remembering. was a formula in the theory section of almost every issue of the Radio Amateur's Handbook from the year one until now. A little exaggeration here. There is a formula where if you tell it the diameter of the coils of your inductor and the total length of the coil and the number of turns, you plug in those numbers, N for the number of turns and D for the diameter and L for the length, you plug those values into that formula and it will tell you the inductance in microhenry. So there's a beautiful formula in there. Because you can make coils so many different ways, different diameters, different spacing, different lengths, different number of turns, very few books will give you graphs on that. There's too many variables involved. Quite possibly, Mattai, Young and Jones, and Zarev, the Russian book on filter synthesis, may have a series of graphs, but very few people own those two rather rare books, expensive books. So the formula is good enough. It'll get you into the ballpark. But the exact measurement, if his meter on his antenna analyzer, he can watch the needle while he takes the frequency knob and rocks the frequency knob back and forth. He will see the needle suddenly jump when he hits resonance. Therefore, he can compare the resonance of the good coil with the new coil. He can make them the same. And make sure that you arrange it in such a way that you're forcing that resonance to be at 14.2 megs on each one. If you compare the resonance at 5.3 megacycles, even though you make them act the same at 5.3 megs, they may not act the same at 14.2. Do it at 14.2, is my strong belief. A person with comments? I think it was Alex Brahead, K2RIW.
Bless you. As for a statement, antenna tuner could serve as an antenna analyzer with or small handheld. The small antenna is very small damage made. And that's the statement. Fourth. And the second, there was a discussion between Howie and a group of people, and I was there about antenna, and I would like to ask you the question to the time is up.
Okay. You could, let me think. If it was the driven element you're working with, and you want to force it to resonate at 14.2, and you find out how you set the loading capacitor and the tuning capacitor on an antenna tuner in order to hit resonance, would that allow you, and you compare that to a known 50 ohm load, yeah, I think with an antenna tuner you could find resonance that way. Another way of doing it is not even with an antenna tuner, just with an impedance bridge or a bird 1 meter connected to your transmission line to your driven element, if it was the driven element, and you swish the frequency of your transmitter by turning the frequency dial while looking at reflected power. Find the frequency of minimum reflected power, the dip in the meter of your bird watt meter. That will allow you to find resonance. But the problem with all of these techniques is that he doesn't have a transmission line going to a driven element as far as the thing of the measurement is concerned. He's trying to measure a coil on a director. He's either got to measure the director one half at a time as a ground plane antenna, or he's got to do it with a loosely coupled coil parallel to the coil he's measuring and use it as a grid dip meter. You got to carefully adjust the spacing until you get loose coupling and see the resonance. You don't wrap one coil over the other. So it's got to be a movable coil connected to a transmission line, connected to something that looks at reflected power when you're feeding it. I think you see where I'm going, Wesley? You got it, Wesley?
And tonight at 8:30,
yes, I agree with you. I'm thinking how to solve the problem with the coil. That's what I'm thinking about it. But there is a question that I want to ask you before the time is up, so fill in with me. I don't want to interrupt you with that subject until we finish. That's it.
Okay. Back to you, Mel. And, this is not the perfect answer. He's going to make a couple of attempts to get it, but don't give up. Even if he doesn't work the first time, it's not going to explode. It's not going to catch on fire. He can keep trying until he gets it right. If he's got the perseverance, he's going to make the antenna better than the manufacturer did the first time. K2KEY, K2LAW, we got about 1 minute left.
Okay, I was just going to say, I have in front of me coil calculator nomogram, and it has several things. It's got number of turns, inductance in Henry, in micro Henry, ratio, diameter to length, and diameter in inches. And if you could give, on this chart, if you look, if you got the inductance in micro Henry, you've got the diameter, and you've got the length. If you just draw across here, it tells you number of turns, Dick. Very nice thing called coil calculator nomogram. Put this out of a old man. Let's see. Oh, boy, this one goes way back. So I'm going to send them this picture. I'm going to send them this copy of it from one of the old handbooks, Radio Mathematics and Calculation, 1947. Okay, talk to you next week. 73 is all. This is K2KEY.
Yeah, I think that's quite good. You're going to mail him that nomogram. Also, tell him about the formula, or give him a copy of it, of the formula in the Radio Amateur's Handbook, where it allows you to calculate microhenries knowing those numbers. It's a beautiful formula. It's got ridiculously high accuracy. Wesley, you got it. K2LAW.
Fantastic. There was a between Howie and the group of the people, and the Howie statement was, with the high gain vertical antenna, if you talking about the far distance from the repeater, you low gain antenna because of the characteristic of the antenna for the constant receiving. In other words, he was trying to say that if you have a high gain antenna, you have more high gain antenna, have more interruptions, while you have a disturbing factors or so stuff like that between repeaters and the question was then how the computer behaves when the antenna is touched. So from the vertical to horizontal. And to exist.
Can you feel a frequency? Yeah, I think his deviation or something is causing the machine to drop out, but I'm hearing him on the input, so I'm getting the whole message. And Wesley, there's two or three different questions involved in that discussion that you and Howie were having. If it was a microwave antenna, as you narrow up the beam width of the antenna, let's just talk about the elevation beam width. If you make it very narrow, you could be hurting yourself under varying conditions where the refraction of the atmosphere and the bounce off of the terrain or whatever allows the signal to, with multipass, form a null into the receiving antenna. And under those conditions, a more broad bandwidth will give you a higher probability of reception.
Reflector 9126, link clear.
Will give you a higher probability of reception. But at the VHF frequencies you and I are talking about, if you actually study the real vertical beamers we're getting most of the time, they're so broad, you don't fall into that category. Second of all, whatever you do to increase the gain of an antenna in the direction of interest, if there's only one main direction, line of sight, so to speak, it always helps. Gain never hurts. Say again?
We would omnidirectional antenna, vertical omnidirectional antenna. Each factor in one is very high and the other one is low. And he said was that for the distance, it's much better to have high gain because of the characteristics of the antenna, which allow you to have a constant level of communication and
yeah, it's possible your PL tone is not quite right. I'm hearing you solidly by listening to the input, but you're dropping out of the machine. Or maybe it's a little bit off frequency. Is it around 146.85? That 5 KC offset? There's something to check on there, Wesley. However,